Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There is resistance to Putin's war in Ukraine around the world. Some of the most courageous protesters have been in Russia. Last week, Marina Osenikova, a television employee, threw herself into a news broadcast brandishing a sign to protest the war. This bravery is remarkable, but it isn't new to Russia. In 2017, I travelled to Moscow to interview another set of brave community activists. For them, this housing and community urban space campaign that we reviewed wasn't their first experience of protest. But their activism, like all activism in Russia, had very high stakes. We see the high stakes in Russia in the press, the treatment of Alexei Navalny or Sergei Magnitsky. But what's true is that for every one of those high-profile people, there are thousands of others risking their lives too, to also make change. To stand with Ukraine and in solidarity with the many Russians fighting for democracy, we present this episode, A Glimpse Inside Russia's Brave Protest Movement. Let's go.
I'm standing in the home of Yulia Rubanova. It's a rectangular apartment. At one end, we're sitting in the kitchen. It's a cute little kitchen.
I was being polite. It was so tiny. The whole apartment was 45 square metres. That's 480 square feet.
It's got wallpaper made of fabric with lots of different colours of purple and yellow and green. And the wall is covered in plates from all places around the world that Yulia's family has travelled. And I can see out the window that's to the side of the kitchen, the beautiful green park where Yulia takes her kids to play almost every day.
So I feed birds here on the window. Birds of different types, they are very nice and unique. They came from nature nearby. And we also have squirrels downside in the park nearby.
You might describe this apartment as a typical apartment that could be in any city in the world, but for Yulia, it's something else.
Today on Changemakers, we're bringing you an episode from Moscow recorded back in 2017. Everyone has a special affinity with their own home. But what happens when the authorities where you live think they can do whatever they like to the place that you call home? Mainly because they have a history of getting their own way. You fight. Let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Series 6 of Changemakers, the podcast telling stories about people changing the world. As well as long-form episodes like this, we feature Changemaker Chats, which are interviews with changemakers. We also have stories about social change campaigns from around the world. We are supported by the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. You can find us on Twitter at Changemakers99 and on Facebook at Changemakers Podcast. You can sign up to our email list at changemakerspodcast.org. There are 7,900 blocks of apartments like Yulia's in Moscow. And when I say like, I mean virtually identical, five-story, prefabricated, white-painted, concrete rectangles.
In Russian it is called Khrushchevka because of time of its building under Khrushchev, our leader.
Like in the West, Russia had a baby boom after World War II, but Stalin didn't do anything about it. Instead, two or three generations of families found themselves crammed into small homes.
It felt like that was how it was going to be for the rest of their lives. But when Stalin died, the new leader Khrushchev decided that he wanted to be loved, not feared. And so he built these apartment blocks for the millions of young families who'd been living with their parents and grandparents. They were a symbol of a new kind of leadership. They were not the most beautiful buildings in the world, but 1.6 million Muscovites are proud to call these brutalist structures their home. Now, the mayor of Moscow, a man named Sergei Sobyan, wants to knock them down, ideally all 7,900 of them. In February 2017, he announced plans to demolish 50,000 apartments, with more to come. It goes by the benign-sounding policy of renovations, and it's stirring genuine opposition in a country where the one thing the government hates more than anything is, genuine opposition. Imagine living in one of those apartments. They look drab from the outside, but inside they're warm. Most of them are solidly built. Everyone I talked to said they couldn't really hear their neighbours through the walls. This was Khrushchev's legacy. Under his policy, 25% of Russians got their own homes. It was a mass urbanisation, the likes the world had never seen before. So the idea was they were homes for young families. But imagine trying to bring up children in a 45 square metre apartment. Where the hell do the kids play? Like everything else, Soviet planners had, well, a plan for that.
Why did you want to live in this area?
So when we were choosing where to live, I used the map and I searched it for green zones because I wanted to play with my children, to walk in the parks. And that's why we chose this part of Moscow.
Parks. Lots of them. Indeed, they were called urban forests because these parks had always been there, before Moscow was an established city. In true communist style, everyone's backyard had been collectivised, clumped together and shared as public space. For years, Yulia had heard about the mayor's renovation plans, but hadn't thought much about it. But in 2016, she found out that the park next door, the whole reason why she was living there, was going to be turned into an apartment block. They were planning to replace the pine forest with another block of units.
We knew about it almost by chance. Our municipal deputy was mailed the documents with information about the further construction.
So they had some documents that said it was going ahead. But when Yulia inquired about it, the authorities reassured her that nothing was happening.
But our local authorities said us that no such construction would take place. They insisted that no such construction would take place.
Not totally trusting the official's reassurance, together with her local representative, Yulia made further inquiries.
So they said we knew nothing about it. We made our research, but nothing is clear. We don't know anything. They said it was hardly possible that such a construction would take place.
And yet trucks were moving in. It was clear that construction was about to start taking place. So Yulia did what any outraged local resident would do.
I took pictures and they sent it to the local organization, which do the protection of natural resources.
You contacted your local environment organization. What were they called?
So it is called Mosprivoda in Russian, which means Moscow's nature. And this is an environmental protection organization. And we send them photos and we apply to them when we want to protect something.
But bureaucracy in Moscow is slow. While they waited for the Environmental Protection Organization to stop the construction, Yulia started talking to her neighbours.
In October, I started talking with other families here to protect the park.
It was at that point Yulia discovered she wasn't alone in wanting to protect the park.
So we live in a huge city, and if we don't have any parks here, it would be impossible to raise children here without clean air. Without any options to walk them in the parks,
многодетных мы собрали 60 подписей.
So we found other activists, people with many children.
Meanwhile, the mayor is not even acknowledging her concerns. When asked about protests against his development plans, he cites a pro-government think tank poll which says 80% of Muscovites support his plans. The mainstream media lapped it up. At the same time, everyone in power that Yulia talks to assured her nothing would happen to the park. It would be illegal to construct anything on the park. After all, the pine forest has been there for hundreds of years. It's essentially heritage listed. Even the roads leading into the park are illegal to drive on. Weeks pass. Then one day, signs go up around the park announcing that construction will begin in just a few days.
You'd been told there was no construction, then you found the signs. How did you feel?
I was shocked.
Можно. У меня перевернулось мое мировоззрение. Я не думала, что у нас в стране такое возможно.
I couldn't believe that such thing is possible in Moscow, in the center of Russia.
Во все черное, и они защитников парка, они просто. Я не думала, что возможно в нашей стране.
It was really shocking thing.
Any uncertainty was now lost. Yulia decided to mobilise. How? They set up a Facebook page, of course.
У нас есть группа в Фейсбуке.
It is called Let's Protect Our Park, Живописный Park. And we post photos there, our letters, and we try to attract people's attention with this group. And also we place signs in the area to let people know what is happening. And we also organized two meetings and two protests.
And for organizing,
how fast was it that other people got involved?
So initially when the construction started, people around here was shocked supported us and 16,000 people signed our petition.
16,000 for a local park? Yulia says that 3,000 to 4,000 of those were offline, with the rest coming through their Facebook group.
Why do you think so many people joined the campaign so quickly?
So it's really important for us. We all love this place. We have squirrels there. We can feed them in summer. We can ski there in winter. And we have beach there also. It's amazing. Everyone loves it.
That's right. It's even got a beach in Russia because Russia is known for its wonderful beaches. Unfortunately, the construction company pushed on.
And also
after that, some people, all in black, appeared in the park suddenly.
Молодых людей, одетых во все черное, и они защитников парка, они просто скрутили.
And they pushed out the activists who tried to protect the park. And it was unbelievable.
So Yulia decided that if the authorities weren't going to stop the illegal construction, she and her neighbours needed to take the law into their own hands.
How did you do that?
Не знаю, мы написали, наверное.
So we tried to block the road.
Remember, this is Russia, where opponents of the government are regularly assassinated. That said, it was a local issue, hardly likely to get the notice of the Kremlin, at least not yet. Yulia and her fellow neighbours took turns blocking the roads from the trucks that were driving to the very active construction site.
Before the protests about the park, had you ever been involved in a protest or social change campaign before?
Нет, никогда.
No, never.
So what did it feel like to block a road to save your park?
Это был очень большой стресс для меня.
So it was really stressful. I might spend this time with my children and family, but I had to block the road.
How did you do it?
So
it is quite silent here. So at night I heard the vehicles going to the construction site once.
Мы пошли туда с мужем в 3 часа ночи.
So 3 a.m. we went there with my husband.
Their neighbors, who also lived next to the park, joined in. The road they were blocking was through a protected area, Cars weren't even allowed to use that road, let alone trucks for a construction site.
So we called the police and we tried to stop vehicles, but against us was about 20 people and we couldn't do anything. The vehicles passed through us. So we asked the police to check whether the vehicles are allowed to go there, but they didn't do that.
Then one day, about a month after the construction begins, finally, Yulia heard back from the Environmental Protection Organisation in charge of stopping illegal construction, the one they'd sent the photos to.
So only 1 month after the start of construction, Mosfry Roda gave them the passes that they are allowed to go to the construction site.
The nature organisation?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you lost your ally. Oh, they turned to the other side. That's a disaster. How did you feel?
So, actually, they were not our allies. They changed their side. We tried to apply to them, but they were on the side of construction organization.
That's how it rolls in the land of Putin. Still, they pressed on when it came to blocking the road. Unfortunately for Yulia, time wasn't on their side, thanks to a very Russian problem.
So you blocked the road for how long?
So it was winter, so 24/7 wasn't possible. We did it from time to time when they could.
The Russian winter. Sure, it stopped Napoleon and Hitler, but now it was stopping Yulia's protests. So instead, her group turned their efforts to navigating their way through the Russian bureaucracy to find an institution or agency that would rule the clearly illegal construction illegal. They wrote to the mayor.
So we got a reply from them that they didn't see any illegal activities and that actually the construction is legal.
This was untrue technically, but the mayor was used to doing things that were technically illegal and getting away with it. He had the support of the Kremlin, and perhaps just as importantly, he was popular among Russian oligarchs. The mayor's attitude was that it was legal if he said it was legal. So what was going on here? How did the construction companies think they could just barrel in and build an apartment block over a much-loved park? Why did the mayor think he could act with impunity? And what do you do when you're fighting an opponent who doesn't stick to the rules? Elena Rusakova is a local activist who ran in the 2012 regional elections.
So it's long ago, in the 1990s, probably, when local authorities first started to consider these green areas as their own property.
Elena says the problem dates back to the 1990s. Before the collapse of communism, the parks were controlled by the Soviet authorities. They were embedded in the idea of collective ownership. The idea that they could be privatised was an anathema to the whole system. But then, when the Iron Curtain came down, the question of who even owned these spaces, who was in charge of the parks, became a genuine puzzle. So, even though there was never any formal decision to make them the property of the city, over the years, that's what happened. But because of this lack of clarity, authorities have become emboldened over the years to do as they wish without reference to the law. And from one perspective, you can understand why. Power abhors a vacuum. As the Soviet state collapsed, it was the people who simply took charge and started running the economy who were the ones who set the rules. And as they did, the ability of the law to rein them in got weaker and weaker.
So the situation is definitely getting worse, this is because of the thing that in the past it was enough to present a law to state that it is illegal to construct something, and then the construction stopped. But now the government uses force and saying that it is illegal is not enough to stop it.
So what do you do when the opponent who doesn't obey the rules is your government? While the construction companies were private, the mayor's construction boom was very much a government thing, complete with a tick of approval from the Kremlin.
Corruption is involved, of course. Even when people go to street protests and say that what you are doing is illegal, it doesn't work because police don't help and government do not respond to it.
Yaroslav Nikitin also lived near Yulia's park and decided to get involved in the fight with Yulia. But Yaroslav wasn't just any resident. He was an experienced social activist. Yaroslav decided to get involved personally to help save the park, especially since the reason for the construction seemed so openly craven to him.
Because the land down parks, it's very expensive. And they just want to construct and they don't care about the future, or they just don't associate their future with this country and with this city. They just want to make quick money here.
In other words, the people who have the power don't have to live with the consequences of their actions. And they were there to make a buck, just like any good oligarch.
Because we have fewer and fewer green areas in Moscow. And the center of Moscow is just a concrete place. And there are very few trees there. And in the center, it's not only about air, but there are many psychological diseases in the center of Moscow because of lack of trees, because of a huge number of automobiles. And this is awful.
So how do they do it? How do they get away with it? For a start, they keep it out of the press.
For example, in the northwest of Moscow, there were absolutely no publications about our fight to save Zhivopisne Park because it's all censored in official media.
That's why the Facebook group became so important.
So how do people find out if their park or their green space is under threat?
These are mostly local activists who just watch Facebook and get news from there.
Of course, it's not just the media. The political leadership also play a role. There again, Yaroslav says there's a problem.
Why do you think the mayor didn't care?
He's pretty confident. If he had no administrative resource, if we had fair elections, I think he would care. But he even said nothing. We had no reaction from him. There is just censorship on his media resources and all that.
So they just ignore you. Yaroslav says the only thing standing between the mayor and the construction were the courts. There again was a problem.
So we have quite corrupt courts who are always on the side of power. Not always, but in most cases. And there are practically no other means to change anything. So we have only public pressure.
Yaroslav and Yulia had generated public pressure, and eventually one institution, an environmental court, ruled in their favour.
Единственный наш союзник – это природоохранная прокуратура. Они подтвердили.
And it confirmed that the area was cemented illegally, that the vehicles had their passes illegally, and that the construction is illegal too.
It was a victory of sorts, but it was too little too late. The mayor and his construction companies now knew they couldn't just barrel into parks with impunity. Up until this point, they'd relied on a compliant media that had kept the project out of the spotlight. But now, Yulia was shining a spotlight on it, and it became too risky. The developers and the mayor were no longer able to act unilaterally. They had to take into account the actions of the locals. The reaction from the government was swift. In late 2016, the mayor announced a new, breathtakingly audacious approach to stamp out the protests.
For example, in the end of 2016, Moscow City Duma, like parliament, they prohibited municipal deputies to gather with their voters.
That's unbelievable.
Yes, it was pretty terrible. And I think we should organize, unite and fight for our rights and fight for local self-governments.
That's right. Local representatives were banned from turning up to protests. It's clear that somebody had a deep incentive to keep the construction boom on track. But Yaroslav says that corruption is not about under-the-table payments in brown paper bags. In Putin's Russia, it runs far deeper than that.
I would say that construction companies are government. There is no bribery. They just...
You make a bid.
Okay, yeah. So they initially make such bids that their own companies, I mean connected companies, they will give the, they will receive this. All rich people in Russia, they are all pretty connected to government. That's why it's one command of oligarchs who rule the country and Moscow as well.
So the fact that Yulia and Yaroslav managed to sort of save their park was a remarkable victory. Dogged persistence by the protesters changed the political calculations about whether stealing public parkland was worth it. It was shining too much of a light on a questionable activity. Moscow officials and their crony construction companies had to take the annoying protesters into account. Back in a moment. This podcast is supported by the Fred Hollows Foundation. 4 out of 5 people who are blind don't need to be. The Fred Hollows Foundation knows how to fix the problem, and they can restore sight for as little as $25 in some countries. Over the past 2 decades, Fred Hollows has restored the sight of more than 2 million people.
Tôi đã có mổ cho một ông mà lúc đó thì ông ấy mù cũng rất nhiều năm rồi.
There was one time when I operated on one man. He was blind for so many years, and after the operation, I followed him back to his home. But he wouldn't go into his house immediately. He just went around touching everything. He touched the cow, he touched the bricks and everything. Because all he could do before was touch, but now he wanted to touch and see at the same time.
Donate today at hollows.org. Okay, so remarkably, Yulia and Yaroslav had stood up to oligarchs and actually saved parts of their park. But now they'd realised that their fight wasn't just about one park. It was a systemic problem that had been going on for years. But what exactly was going on? That's when they met Sergei Menjiritsky. Sergei had spent the last 7 years trying to answer the same question.
Более того, я хочу сказать, что, вы знаете, до 2009 года я был
After 2009, I supported Mr. Putin and the current government absolutely. I was pro-Putin. I grew up in a family full of people from army and military-oriented people. My brother is now in the army, and all my predecessors were there in the Soviet times and under the Russian Tsars and all this.
But for Sergei, everything changed in 2009.
At that time, I went to the Russian coast of the Black Sea, near Gelenzyk, one of the more favourite places. Gelenzyk is a unique place because there are forests of pines there. This is a special type of pine that covers only 1,200 hectares all over the world. It's really unique.
It had special significance for Sergei.
Very beautiful pine.
For me, from my childhood, this place was like a heaven on earth because I enjoyed walking along the sea near this pine forest. And this is a really beautiful place. I loved it so much.
But in 2009, when Sergei went back there for a holiday...
I went there and I saw a fence and I saw no end of this fence. So it was like a bad dream because I went to my favourite forest, but I saw a fence and guards with dogs walking nearby. And it was a fence between the sea line and the forest.
The coastline, the beach and the forest had all been privatised. Enraged, Sergei found a gap in the fence and went through.
I saw thousands of unique pines destroyed. I saw the area prepared for construction, of a palace.
A distillery to produce wine and alcohol had also been built. The forest and the construction site were on protected land. Sergei wrote to the government and they confirmed that the land was essentially like a national park, something for everyone to enjoy.
And yet there were fences and guard dogs.
Я понял, что произошло тяжкое преступление против нашего народа. И мне было интересно, кто автор этого.
So I consider this a crime not only against ecology, but against all people and all humankind. I consider it in this way.
Then the following winter, all was revealed. Unbeknownst to the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, a deal had been secretly struck between Russian businessman Sergei Kolesnikov and the then Prime Minister.
Владимир Владимирович Путин.
Vladimir Putin. It was a done deal. Regardless of whether it was legal, with Putin's backing, there was nothing anyone could do.
Что делает господин Олег Перл? Он ставит 4-метровый забор, выставляет охрану и превращает...
So Alec Berov, who is head of the local organisation, he arranged a fence there of 4 metres high. He puts guards near the fence, so now it's like his own property, his home. His family spend time there. He puts their statues and everything. And all this, well, we don't have a lot of beaches here.
У нас берегов, где можно отдохнуть, по-настоящему очень мало. Этот ресурс.
So Russia is quite a cold country, and here are coastlines and beaches where you can spend time in summer. It's a unique resource, and it has always been protected by the government. So what happened now with the privatization of the past unique natural reserves? It has no parallels in the history of Russia. It's unbelievable.
To Sergei, this raised fundamental questions.
И вот вся эта информация, которую я на своем личном опыте увидел, получил.
So after my research, I started thinking, what is our government and how could I communicate with it?
Вопрос очень важный. То есть я представляю нашу власть.
So the government should help people solve issues. But this situation was the opposite. Like the government created the issues.
For Sergei, all roads led to the people behind the scheme, which included some familiar faces.
Everyone knows the current mayor of Moscow, Sobyan, and Alek Berov, who's head of Lukoil Corporation, are friends. Some time ago, Sobyan was mayor of Kogalym. Its region was central for oil business. So it is the same scenario each and every time. If you are in government or a friend of government, you can go illegal.
So Sobyan came to power as mayor of Moscow. He had a lot of business links to an oil-rich region. But then in 2012, the US passed the Magnitsky Act. Yep, you might have heard of it. The law that sanctioned Russian oligarchs and drove Putin to support Trump in the 2016 election. Before the Magnitsky Act, Russia's gas and oil magnates would make their fortunes and then move their families and their fortunes to London or Monaco or Malta.
Such representatives of the government get their resources and then move to foreign democratic well countries. And they had no obstacles to do it.
But after the Magnitsky Act, corrupt oligarchs, Putin's support base, had nowhere to go. And nowhere offshore to put their money. Western banks were forbidden from touching it. It was a real problem for them and a real headache for Putin. Suddenly, the whole reason the oligarchs supported him had disappeared. Sobyan's plans for Moscow seemed like the perfect business opportunity and a perfect way for the Kremlin to keep their favoured oligarchs with plenty of profit-making ventures on their hands. It was domestic, it was funded by the government, which was a fairly limitless resource of money. And best of all, it was being run by their old mate, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyan.
Дело в том, что застройка московского региона – это новый нефть и газ вот нашего времени.
So construction in Moscow, it's like new oil, because you cannot get so much money from anything else. And besides, these businessmen who are involved in construction, they are linked to the government. So it's a means of... If you want to understand the aim of someone, you need to understand the means.
Вот мне важно, чтобы именно эти термины прозвучали. Цель, aim, средство.
In other words, if the government had truly wanted to do something about improving housing for 1.6 million people, they would have actually talked to the residents about what they wanted. Instead, they brought in construction companies and gave them carte blanche. It suggested that serving the interests of the construction oligarchs was the true aim of the policy. So in stopping construction on their park, Yulia and Yaroslav had found themselves taking on powerful forces. They were taking on the entire Russian establishment. This wasn't just about a park. This was about the future of the city and who got to decide what it looked like, the residents or the billionaires. To win, it seemed obvious that they needed to broaden their front. They'd heard about other protests in other parts of Moscow. Someone had even set up a Facebook page to keep track of it all. But each group was isolated. Each group was fighting the same fight against the same opponent, but not coordinating amongst each other. Vasily Yablokov was the coordinator of the urban projects at Greenpeace Russia, and also conveniently the head of research. Yaroslav had a chat to Vasily about the problem. The thing is, this was not usually the sort of battle that Greenpeace would get involved in.
It's very local and very small, and Greenpeace doesn't have a position, strong position about local problems.
Usually Greenpeace works on big international problems, but Vasily had a very pragmatic approach. Many of Greenpeace's potential volunteers were affected by the mayor's plan.
Our people who can be our potential supporters live in the cities, and we should work with their local reality because we need the people, because we people power organization.
Vasily also had skin in the game. The government wanted to build a freeway through his local park, showing how politicising these battles could be. He decided to tear up the Greenpeace rulebook. The other side weren't playing by the rulebook anyway.
Now it's our position that we Greenpeace can't work with all local problems and we should raise activism in cities.
They decided they needed to form a network of all the small protest groups. But before they could do that, they needed to get a handle on what the hell was going on, which projects were legal. Under Moscow's planning laws, you can't just build an apartment block without also building the necessary schools, hospitals, shops and roads. But this was something that the mayor had completely neglected.
We found a lot of illegal points of this project.
Yulia Galimania was a well-known local activist in a different part of Moscow.
So in March 2016, Greenpeace, together with Human Rights Institution, organized a research into the problem and created a report on it. So at that time and before, the problem was understood.
It's a Moscow's problem, whole Moscow problem.
As part of the research, they spoke to the designers and the lawyers and suggested changes to the mayor's plans, but nothing happened. Vasily says that's because in the political theatre, the technocrats working on the plan were guileless to the broader political context.
These people have a row of stupid people where don't understand anything.
Sergei Mendritsky helped out, running a website called Open Coast. Initially, it was just to monitor the illegal sales of coastal property, but has since blossomed into a registry of all the illegal sales of land.
Да, это реестр украденных берегов Российской Федерации. Там каждый гражданин.
It's like a register on my website.
Правда, она работает почему-то с большими проблемами.
It's like a map of so-called stolen coastlines of Russia.
Украл берег какой-то глава администрации, например, взял под свою дачу, украл.
And any citizen of Russia can go to my website and put a point on the map if he or she thinks this part of the coastline is stolen.
Does it include any sites or sales inside of Moscow?
Yeah, it includes Moscow, and there are a lot of illegal activities which is pointed there, which took place previous. Yeah, I mentioned some examples.
Is this one way that many Moscovites can find out about illegal sales?
На моем сайте есть еще инструкция.
Yeah, I have a lot of other helpful resources on my site. Not only the map itself, but also guidelines and instructions on how to act when you see a fence on coastline. So first, people who see, they are shocked, they are angry. But if they go to my website, they can see how they should act.
So in my country, the government provides the information that you provide. Why doesn't the government provide this information?
подтверждает вот то, что я сказал, что, к сожалению, наша власть приватизирована и действует не в интересах большинства.
The fact that government do not provide such information proves that the government is corrupted and works for its own interest, not for the interest supporting their people.
Они не ведут даже статистику захваченных берегов в России. Вот я общался с...
So the head of the Land Titles Office does not do such a register of occupied coastlines. They should do it, but they don't.
Вы проводите обследование берегов.
In effect, they were answering the problem that lay at the heart of their strategic dilemma. If the government wasn't going to behave like a government and follow the rules, the protesters would start writing their own rules. They would keep track of the records. They would be the reliable source of legitimate information. They were filling the vacuum of legitimate government.
Я вам уже говорил о том, что в результате общественного договора люди практически отстранены.
So people are far away from all the mechanisms that work for decision making, and it is hard to fight against it. So actually, Putin's system is called the system of decorative democracy.
The protesters' role was to bring decision making within the reach of those affected. The residents of Moscow. Thanks to the report and several local green space victories, for the first time, the mainstream media were paying more attention. It was clear these people were not shabby radicals, but a reliable source of information in the face of a slippery administration.
It was very cool because we use media like a pressure for government.
And thanks to Vasily's network coordinating local groups, the protests started getting bigger. Suddenly, it was part of the national politics in Russia, thanks to Greenpeace executive director Sergei Tablonka.
Every year, Putin has a meeting with members of Human Rights Council. And Sergei, who is a member of this council, talked directly to Putin about the situation with Park Pskova. It was strange because it's not like a human rights problem. It's an environmental problem. But it was like a quintessence of this meeting with Putin. And Putin was like surprised about this situation. Why Moscow government cutting the forest for constructing roads, and he said, okay, I asked mayor of Moscow about his situation.
Putin was shocked, but surprise, surprise, nothing changed. The mayor kept going, demolishing parks all around Moscow, all but confirming which side Putin was on. Then in February 2017, just as winter was at its most bitter, the mayor announced his boldest plan yet. 50,000 apartments would be razed to the ground as phase one of a massive so-called renovation. That's 7,900 apartment blocks. Ironically, in a way, this was exactly the sort of overreach that the protesters needed. Now it wasn't just your park that was being threatened with illegal demolition, it was your home. The pace of organising picked up speed. Step one, petitions. Yulia Galimania, who had previously run for office, knew how to organise.
So there are about 30 houses, flats, block of flats in the district where I live. And in a week we gathered about 1,000 signatures.
But they didn't just stop at petitions.
So after that, when we get connected to people, we found one or two activists in each house in our district.
They were organising at a hyper-local level, but they couldn't just play locally on an issue that was affecting the whole city. They had to go broad as well.
Главным образом интернет.
So basically we used internet.
Facebook, yet again. Several Facebook pages were set up. The largest was...
Moscovites against destruction of buildings.
So this group
probably has about 30,000 followers, but it's not the only one group.
To build on the momentum, they decided to hold a meeting in Pushkin Square. The idea was to show that they were not just a fringe group, but a major political force. Through the coordination of all the local protest groups, on the 14th of May, 60,000 people across Russia protested, the largest protest in 5 years.
In the footage, heavily armed anti-riot police use batons to pull down protest placards attached to the statue in the square.
Стало требовать его задержания. Я сказала, что нет, это я его пригласила, пускай он остается. И тогда представитель мэрии сказал.
And later, Alexei Navalny...
That's basically Russia's de facto opposition leader.
...go to near this scene of this meeting and he started to have some quarrels with police. Police tried to arrest him.
Remarkably and rapidly, the rally had an effect. The protest march was in mid-May. By the end of the month, the mayor had massively scaled back his ambitions, halving the number of apartment blocks scheduled for demolition.
And what kind of message do you think the rally sent to the mayor about renovations and about the changes to green spaces?
Очень сложно. Если бы мы какую-то отдачу получали там,
so it's really hard. But anyway, it was worth it because after our protests, we had some changes and amendments to the law. And if before that you had only 60 days to relocate if your home is to be renovated, now you have 90 days. And
It's something because it allows protesters extra time to organise to stop demolitions. You see, if you can get 70% of your building to oppose the demolition, you can now veto it. This change in the law gave people like Yulia the space she needed to stop the demolition of her apartment block. Beyond that, it shows that the protesters had achieved some recognition in one of the hardest sites for protest in the world. The rally made the mayor realise that he must take the people into account. Not only that, but one poll conducted after the protest said 58% of Muscovites supported the protest, which greatly undermined the mayor's claim that 80% of people supported demolitions. The fight is far from over. Some distant observers see echoes of the 2012 protest movement in this latest surge. Back then, 120,000 filed onto the streets of Moscow in the wake of a national election that was decorative democracy at its finest. But there are key differences to this protest movement. For a start, it's grounded by very specific local concerns. Many of those involved are not there out of some political ambition, but simply out of a desire to protect their homes, and whose eyes have now been opened to the flagrant corruption of the system.
How has this campaign, all this work, changed how you think about the government?
So my opinion about government turned upside down. And I understood that all power is in the hands of rich people and only they can decide what to do next in our country.
So what would you do if you were them? Here, the protesters themselves are divided. Some, like Yulia Rubanova, decided that the only way to force accountability on the Moscow Duma was to join it. She decided to run in the local elections. After all, as Yaroslav points out, most of the local campaigns still lose to those in power. Perhaps they'll have more impact if they have someone representing them from within.
Most of campaigns are being lost, but if we lose, we can win in elections, for example. It could be a good outcome from this.
And Yulia Galamania believes that only by participating can democracy become less rigged.
So people considered all elections in the government as rigged elections, and so they didn't participate in it at all. So the world will not change it's by itself. You need to do something to make change to the world.
Others like Sergi and Vasily believe that acting outside the political system will bear more fruit. Sergi's website will continue to be the definitive register of illegal land sales in Moscow, and Vasily's coordination of local groups will ensure that protesters can bring citywide scale to local concerns. In sticking with his approach of simply doing the government's work for it, Sergi is expanding the concept of local boards,
which are like standing committees that keep pressure on the local deputies and provide them with truthful information.
So when we create a normal independent local board, we can get this brain and or these mechanisms of communication with the whole living organism. And in that case, the government at the city level will get proper information about what is going on in the districts, because now they have signals only from the high levels of power.
Every state has a power dynamic where the people can play a role, even in Russia, where the government has a track record of literally killing its opponents. This social movement was particularly effective because it was based on the day-to-day experience of Moscovites. It was first based on their love of their treasured green spaces and their attachment to their homes. It was grounded in place, in the spaces that people live in every day. It meant that everyday people, people who had never been involved in political life, felt comfortable stepping into political action. And the process of being political, of contesting power, taught them so much about how the system worked. They learned the force they were up against when their environmental organisation sided with the construction company. They were taught about real politics when the apartment block was built despite it being illegal. These moments provided those involved with lessons about how the Russian state worked. Then the state overreached with its decision to demolish tens of thousands of homes. This then caused an equal and opposite reaction by the people that forced this decorative democracy to compromise. These change makers haven't won in Moscow, but they have not lost either. The most important lesson they have gained is that they have learnt how to fight. Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all of our episodes. This is now Series 6, so there's plenty to be inspired by in our back catalogue. This episode was written by Charles Firth. Our audio producer is Jules Wookera, and our digital manager is Lachlan Hodson. Our sponsoring organisation is the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. They break down barriers between researchers, policymakers, and community campaigners so we can build change together. Check them out at sydney.edu.au/policy-lab. Like us on Facebook at Changemakers Podcast, and check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories. And don't forget to check out our Changemakers Organising School if you want to take a deeper dive into the art of changemaking.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.